Hello, I'm Stephen Fry, a trustee of the Royal Academy of Arts, and very proud to be so. Welcome to our podcast.
Well, there seem to be many anniversaries of important historical events to choose from at the moment, with the ongoing First World War commemorations, and this year the anniversary of not only Magna Carta, but also the famous battles of Agincourt and Waterloo. And the bicentenary of the latter, which, as I'm sure you're all aware, took place on the 18th of June this year, has given rise to a crop of new books, exhibitions and events exploring the significance of this decisive moment in European history. But at the Royal Academy, the anniversary of Waterloo has provided a much-needed catalyst for bringing one of the treasures of the RA collections out of the vaults, having it conserved and put on public display for the first time in over 40 years, and that's all been thanks to funding from Arts Council England. The work in question is the Waterloo cartoon by Daniel McLees. To give it its proper title, it's the full-scale preparatory drawing for his wall painting in the Royal Gallery of the House of Lords, entitled The Meeting of Wellington and Blücher After the Battle of Waterloo. And I'm usually a real stickler for using proper titles, but I think you can probably appreciate why we didn't put that on the poster in this case. McLees's wall painting of the scene can still be seen in situ today if you're lucky enough to get into the Royal Gallery while the Lords aren't using it. And there's an opportunity to do that at the moment. There's actually an exhibition on in there about the wall painting until, I think, the 24th of September. But McLees drew the cartoon between 1858 to 59 and used it to produce the wall painting, which he'd finished by 1861. The cartoon was then purchased in 1870, following the artist's death, by the Royal Academy as a sort of memorial to him. And it was on continuous display here at Burlington House for about 50 years. However, it then subsequently spent most of the 20th century in storage, which I'll say a little bit more about at the end. But it has become quite commonplace in museum marketing speak to talk about hidden treasures and things coming out of the vaults. But we're really not lying or exaggerating in this case. It's been genuinely well and truly hidden, because the last time it was on public display was in 1972 at the National Portrait Gallery. And before that, it was in storage for a further four decades. And when I say not on public display, it wasn't just in a storeroom that we could go in and look at. It was actually off limits to researchers and even to members of the Royal Academy staff as well. So I'd worked here for 10 years before I got to see it. And this is a photo of us at the first viewing that we had of the cartoon in 2012. But even though it was unappreciated for such a long time, it can still definitely be called a treasure. It's a really exceptional object, being probably the largest surviving drawing of its kind in the UK. It's drawn on an epic scale, but it's nevertheless incredibly detailed. A contemporary critic described it as being lined and hatched like a giant lithograph. And that level of finish, particularly in Victorian drawings, can sometimes really kill the drawing and deaden it. But in this case, it seems to be what gives the cartoon its life and gives it great power and presence. So it's been very exciting to see the cartoon conserved and redisplayed in time for the anniversary. And this is just to show you, before it came to the Royal Academy, where it was put up a couple of weeks ago, it was actually at the Royal Armouries in Leeds at the Art of Battle exhibition that they had there, which covered the actual anniversary of Waterloo. And we worked in partnership with the curators at the Armouries to do a lot of research into the history of the cartoon and their expertise in identifying weapons and all of the military uniform depicted really helped us to identify who's who and what's what, and really increased our understanding of it enormously. So it's a huge work, and there's plenty to say about it, but to try to give this introduction a little bit of structure, I'm firstly just going to give a bit of background on McLees himself and why he went to such lengths to produce this cartoon. It's very unusual to have spent so much time and effort on a preparatory drawing, so I think that's worth considering before we look at the image itself. But then the main part of the talk will be to look in more detail at McLees's depiction of Wellington and Blücher, how he composed the image, what challenges he faced in producing it and what he was trying to convey. And then lastly, I was just going to give a brief account of why the cartoon ended up being hidden for the last 100 years or so, and the recent process of conserving it. So on the left is a photo of MacLise around the time that he created the cartoon. He was born in 1806 in the city of Cork in Ireland. His father ran a tannery and shoemaking business, but rather than going into the family business, MacLise showed an early talent for drawing and was encouraged by local collectors and antiquarians like Richard Sainthill to attend the School of Art in Cork, which he did from around 1820. And encouraged again by the same people, he moved to London in 1827 to attend the RA schools, where he carried off all the prizes because he was pretty much a trained artist already. But he settled in London for life and later described himself as a cocknified Corkonian. He was elected a Royal Academician in 1840 at the early age of 36 and was in great demand throughout his whole career, really, as a portraitist, a book illustrator, and a history painter. But I think it's, despite all that, fair to say that he's no longer a household name, even if some of his works might be quite familiar today. For instance, his portrait of his friend Charles Dickens is still quite well known. And the two were good friends, and even coincidentally died within a few weeks of each other. Dickens survived just long enough to deliver a eulogy for MacLise at the RA annual dinner in 1870. He described him as the gentlest and most modest of men, which does ring true with other descriptions of him, but it has to be said that for someone so modest, he managed to achieve a good deal and was very successful. And he possessed a certain amount of ambition on behalf of his art, at least, even if it wasn't for his own personal gain. And that's something that comes out in the story of the cartoon. But to understand why he put so much work into the Waterloo cartoon, I think it's useful just to look quickly at his involvement with the project to decorate the newly rebuilt Palace of Westminster as a whole. So these prints just show some of the cartoon competitions that were held there in the 1840s. After the Houses of Parliament burned down in 1834 and were rebuilt by A.W.N. Pugin and Charles Barry, there was also a committee formed to decide on the interior decoration of the buildings, headed by Prince Albert and Sir Charles Eastlake. And in their search for artists to create grand site-specific history paintings and sculptures celebrating the nation's heritage, they decided that the best way to see what was on offer in Britain at the time was to hold these competitions where the artist would produce a cartoon, which wasn't quite as much of a commitment as producing a painting, but would give them an idea of what they were capable on a large scale, because a lot of the fashionable paintings of the time were actually quite tiny. MacLise didn't enter the first cartoon. He was an established artist by this point, and I think he might have seen it as a bit below him to have to tout for work in this way. But further competitions were held, and as it became clear that it was something worth getting involved with, he did enter and, unsurprisingly, was one of the artists chosen to be given a commission. And the first works he produced were these two frescoes, which you can still see in the chamber of the House of Lords, and shows this sort of medievalising style that he had at the time, and that really found favour with Prince Albert and Eastlake. But there's quite a sort of robustness to the figures, which have this physical presence that you don't always get in this sort of style. So that's something you see again in the cartoon. But the process of commissioning artists for all the different spaces was very long-winded, and after those frescoes, MacLise continued in negotiation with the commissioners, and by the 1850s, he was asked to reproduce this work, The Marriage of Strongbow and Aoife, as a fresco at Westminster. And that's something they talked about for quite a long time, but it never came to fruition. But I put this up because it's quite an interesting parallel with the meeting of Wellington and Blücher. Although it's a medieval scene, it's also showing the aftermath of a battle. Despite the romantic sounding title, it's showing this marriage actually taking place on the battlefield. And this seems to have been where he started exploring some of his ideas that come out in the cartoon. Another thing he worked on around this time was a series of drawings of the Norman conquest. He was hoping to interest the commissioners in this for Westminster. But for some reason, although the drawings were really a critical success when they were exhibited in London, the commissioners didn't go for it, and so these were just reproduced later as prints in the 1860s. But the Royal Gallery interested Maclise because it had been earmarked as a space in which to celebrate what was described as the military history and glory of the country, and 18 scenes had been set by the commissioners to illustrate this theme. And they began with Boadicea inciting her army and then chronologically went up to Trafalgar and Waterloo. And they're quite an interesting group of scenes that they chose. They're quite inclusive. There are a lot of women involved in them, and they're also often highlighting self-sacrifice and heroism rather than straightforward military prowess. So it's not necessarily what you might expect from the Victorian Fine Art Commission. But the scene that Maclise took an interest in straight away was the last one, the meeting of Wellington and Blücher, which was earmarked for one of the large compartments. There's two on either side in the gallery. One was to show the death of Nelson at Trafalgar, and the other to show the aftermath of Waterloo. But he seems to have taken to this one straight away. And he explained to Eastlake and Prince Albert that he was interested in painting all 18 scenes in the gallery. And they were fairly supportive of this, but they couldn't give him the contract straight away because really of bureaucratic constraints. And what's interesting about this is that you can follow the whole story in the correspondence, which is still kept in the National Art Library at the V&A. So I just thought I'd show you one of the letters they have there, written by Prince Albert. And it's not very easy to read because this writing's terrible, but on the right-hand side, there's a sentence there just saying he's got this letter from Maclise about the offer, and he says it does him great honour. But on the right-hand side, he says, "I hope Mr. Maclise will understand that we can't give him the commission until next year." So he was kind of encouraged at this stage, but not given the commission. And so I'd initially assumed that Maclise had been asked to produce the cartoon by the commissioners so they could get an idea of what he was going to do. But reading all of that correspondence, it turns out that, in fact, they actually tried to put him off. In February 1858, he was given official approval for the Royal Gallery project, but with the proviso that he begin instead with one of the smaller and much less ambitious scenes. Eastlake tried to explain this to Maclise, saying that this was so that his section would form a whole by itself if the project were to be interrupted by your death, for we must look to all contingencies in so great a scheme. Now, given that I think he was only in his 40s at this stage, that wasn't a ringing endorsement. And it seems to have really goaded Maclise a little bit. So he informed the commissioners that he would do what they asked, but that he wanted to finish his cartoon of this scene first. And I think it's clear at this stage that he then went all out to produce a drawing that would bowl them over and make them change their mind. Not only let him start with Wellington and Blücher, but give him the whole contract. It seems very unlikely that he ever intended to use this as a traditional cartoon, that is, to use it to physically transfer the composition to the wall. And hopefully that's illustrated by these two details. On the left is the head of a Highlander from the cartoon, and I mean, you can see there's nothing that's damaged that area of the cartoon. But on the right-hand side is a cartoon by Raphael, which shows that it's been pricked along the outlines. And the way that was used was to then put it onto the wall, rub pigment over the back, and to transfer an outline onto the wall. But I think the fact that Maclise drew the cartoon in such meticulous detail shows that he always intended to copy it by eye rather than using this method. He spent over a year working on the drawing. Completing the whole thing in black chalk with a dash of coloured pigment here and there. And I think you can see from this detail that he mostly used a linear technique known as hatching, which is really labour-intensive, but it can produce very effective and precise results, and it makes the drawing very visually robust. As you'll see when you look at the cartoon, he drew on 10 separate sheets of paper, but he then had a bespoke frame made which would join them all together in one image. And I think he probably had that put together first in the Royal Gallery to draw the outline of the composition, and then he worked on each one individually in his own studio in Russell Square. But the tactic worked. The cartoon was displayed in the Royal Gallery for the commissioners to view in the summer of 1859, and they were actually quite slow to go and see it. I mean, maybe they had a few better things to do, or they were on their holidays or something. But only a few of them had been in. But then Prince Albert went to see it, and that changed the whole thing, because he thought it was amazing, and he really took up the project and pushed it forward. And within a few months, Maclise was working on the wall painting. The public were then allowed in to see the drawing as well, and it caused a huge sensation in the press, with artists and critics hailing it as a masterpiece. And Maclise even got a letter of congratulation from about 40 of his fellow artists, and they presented him with a little gold port crayon, which, you know, it's not a huge prize for such a drawing, but it was really an expression of their solidarity with him for having created such an amazing work. But so what does the scene depict? The event that Maclise was so keen to represent was, of course, the meeting of the Duke of Wellington and the Prussian Field Marshal, Gebhard von Blücher, or Blücher, which occurred by coincidence rather than arrangement after the battle itself, when the two leaders and their attendants basically bumped into each other at around 9 or 10 in the evening on the road outside Waterloo. And they're said to have been both on horseback as they shook hands, and Wellington recalled that Blücher embraced him and said "quelle affaire" in French before they made the agreement that the Prussians would continue with their pursuit of the French while Wellington's troops retired. And this subject, of course, came with certain challenges, mainly revolving around the level of historical accuracy required and the balance between getting the facts right and creating an effective work of art. At the time, the subject of Waterloo had been given greater contemporary relevance by the fact that the Duke of Wellington had died in 1852, so there had been a lot of commemorative events and artworks. There was also the 50th anniversary of the battle approaching in 1865, and the alliance between Britain and the Prussians was something that, of course, particularly appealed to Prince Albert of Saxe-Coburg-Gotha, who was heading the Fine Art Commission. But Maclise's representation is of particular note as a Victorian depiction of Waterloo, but one that was created while the event was still just within living memory. So he really had to do a lot of research to make this plausible to the people who were going to see it. And these are a few examples of an album of hundreds of little sketches and notes that he made as part of his research, and that's kept in the Parliamentary Art Collection. Victorian critics were very excited about the idea that he had this great level of historical accuracy, but in fact, working with the Royal Armoury's curators has turned up the fact that actually there are quite a lot of discrepancies in the scene. But what's interesting about those is that I think some of them are deliberate, but others are just mistakes. So I'll point out a couple of those as we go along. But he did consult written accounts of eyewitnesses, visual sources, and actual items of weaponry and uniform that were in use on the day. So in the middle you can see the Duke of Wellington's sword, which he did get right, but other things not so much, as we'll see as we go along. But he also put a lot of thought into the design of the composition, and the result is a very sophisticated and subtle image, which works as a whole, but it also functions in three separate sections. So to begin with, you have this portrait of Wellington and Blücher in the centre. When you look at the whole cartoon, it's interesting how Wellington subtly just takes up more space, and he's right in the centre of the composition with his horse across the pictorial plane. So although they're kind of given equal billing here in the handshake, he just subtly made Wellington a little bit more important there. But this is really a faithful portrait of the two as they were described on the day. And the most important visual sources for Maclise's depiction of the Duke were apparently these two portraits by Sir Thomas Lawrence. Now, Maclise is recorded as having looked at the one on the left, this more glamorised portrait of Wellington in his red uniform, which is at Windsor Castle. But I think it's fairly clear just from looking at them that he was actually more interested in this one on the right from a private collection, and I think he must have consulted this. This purports to show the Duke in the exact clothing that he wore at the battle. So you can see the correspondence there. And in Maclise's representation, Wellington is even less glamorised in a way because he doesn't have the same kind of heroic pose as in Lawrence's painting. And it's as though Maclise seemed to be almost trying to scrape back some of the layers of Wellington's public image to get back to an idea of the man himself. Blücher posed more of a problem because there were images of the Duke of Wellington all over the place, but not so many of Blücher. Maclise did find some official portraits of him, but these showed him in his full uniform wearing a hat and feathers. And he drew him like that, but just as he had finished this minutely detailed work, Prince Albert forwarded Maclise a letter from General Nostitz, who was Blücher's former aide-de-camp, including a sketch of the headgear that Blücher had worn at Waterloo, which turned out to be a forage cap, which I had no clue about, but apparently looks more like this. So what Maclise did here was, having just finished this immaculate drawing, he pasted some thin paper over the top of Blücher's head and redrew the hat so that it was correct. So he was really concerned about getting it right. He could have just said, I'll make this better in the wall painting, but he actually intervened in his own drawing in this way to make it correct. So that's something, when you look at the drawing, it appears like an area of damage, and there are plenty of areas of damage, but that's not one of them. It's something that the artist did himself. Unfortunately, restorers later tried to cover it up, which kind of made it more obvious, but that's what that's about. But there is, however, a fundamental historical discrepancy here, and you can see above Blücher's head the sign "À la Belle Alliance." Well, Wellington was absolutely adamant that he didn't meet Blücher at the Inn of the Belle Alliance, and had published letters saying this in the press. But luckily, the Duke of Wellington was dead, so Maclise could do what he liked. And other eyewitnesses did continue to claim that they had met at the Belle Alliance, and the Prussians even called the whole battle by that title. So, I mean, the apt name of this inn and the fact that it had been Napoleon's headquarters earlier in the day made the setting just too much of a gift to pass up. And I think also emphasises the fact that the image was really created 4 decades after Waterloo, so it's not for the Duke of Wellington or even his army and the people who were there. It's for a Victorian audience, and specifically to appeal to Prince Albert and Queen Victoria. So after the portrait in the middle, on either side, Maclise then added identifiable members of the staff of both the leaders. And here he was given carte blanche to use artistic license by the committee, who suggested that he include personnel who were known to be at Waterloo but weren't recorded as being there at this particular moment. It turned out that the two leaders were said to be almost alone at the time they met, which would have caused quite a problem for this composition. So behind Blücher are members of his staff. The man whose head you can see just behind Blücher's shoulder is Nostitz, who provided quite a lot of information for Maclise via Prince Albert and Eastlake. But others of note include Blücher's chief of staff, General von Gneisenau, not very good at the pronunciation of some of these. He's the one in the hat and feathers, about 2 figures away from Blücher. The soldier in the helmet and breastplate is supposed to be Prince Frederick of Prussia. And further along to the left is another man with the hat and feathers. And he's General von Bülow, one of Blücher's commanders. And the man a little bit further along in a sort of red-tinged hat is General Zieten, who was commander of the Prussian First Corps. The exception here is the man on horseback with the leopard-skin saddle, and that's General Sir Richard Hussey Vivian, which is a great name, who was the commander of Wellington's 6th Cavalry Brigade. And then on the left, as a sort of picturesque vignette, Maclise included the Prussian band who were said to have struck up God Save the King when they saw the British troops arriving on this road. So on the other side, on the right, you get something similar behind Wellington, although interestingly it's not so extensive. There are only a few identifiable people here, and I'm not sure if that was to put the focus particularly on Wellington himself or whether it was to point out that many of his staff were actually killed and injured in the battle. But either way, there are only a few of them. The one in the bicorn hat is Lord Arthur Hill, but the one whose head just peeps in between him and Wellington is the Honourable Henry Percy, who carried the Waterloo dispatch to London. And you can see that their faces are, you know, have individual features to make them identifiable. But on the right is this crowd who are from the lifeguards and the horse guards, and they look like he's just got one or two models and shown their faces from different angles. That could be seen as lazy, or it could be seen as a way of putting the focus on the people who are identifiable figures. Now, something interesting here that we found out from the armories is that these guys are all brandishing their swords aloft and cheering the conquering hero, but they're actually carrying French swords. So he got that one very wrong. And I think in this case, this was just a genuine mistake because, you know, he wasn't a military historian or an armor expert. He went to various collections and asked to see things that they had from Waterloo. And inevitably, a lot of English collections were more interested in war trophies from the French than they were in swords which were still in use maybe 10 years later in the British Army. So I think he was probably just shown a French sword. So after this group, then the composition widens out again on either side. And these groups are more emblematic of the whole battle rather than just this one moment. And without these, the image of the two leaders shaking hands wouldn't really have so much significance. And again, Maclise deviated from accounts of the battle to some extent because he knew that many of these figures and these incidents wouldn't have been seen at this particular location, although they did happen in the Battle of Waterloo. Eastlake, for one, said this was quite allowable, writing that otherwise the picture would have represented a meeting indeed, but not after a battle, which I think sums it up. So there are several groups here displaying acts of compassion. There are soldiers who are helping their comrades and even some helping their enemies. An officer on the far right there, actually you can see it in the middle of this part of the composition, is receiving last rites from a priest. And he's accompanied by the only two women in the scene, a sister of charity and a vivandière. Vivandière was one of the delightfully named camp followers who sold food and drink to the troops and followed them around. The dead soldier on the left who's being carried away by a group of his comrades is supposed to represent Lord Byron's cousin who died at Waterloo and who features in his epic poem Childe Harold's Pilgrimage, described as the young gallant Howard. But Maclise really went to great lengths to represent all nationalities involved in the battle. So the British troops include members of English regiments, as well as the King's German Legion, Highlanders, and members of the Irish Enniskillen Dragoons, who you can see right in the corner here. It's actually written on his helmet, so that was an easy one to identify. Napoleon's French troops are accompanied by soldiers from his Polish and Dutch squadrons. And this is on the left-hand side, and you see similar groups here. But the composition that he devised is a very clever compromise between celebrating the leaders themselves while also honouring not only their named staff but also the rank and file. And this is a very Victorian concern and one that presumably was made more relevant at this time by the recent experience of the Crimean War. But what motivated Maclise to devote so much time and energy into researching, devising and drawing this cartoon? This is an image of him at work in the Royal Gallery, but actually on the death of Nelson, but it's just a nice image. But I think the answer is that he really wanted to make his mark at Westminster in the Royal Gallery. His early works were very popular, but there was a sense that they were perhaps a little bit frivolous. They depict often historical scenes, but often based on literary sources. For instance, this one showing an incident from one of Shakespeare's plays. And this was one of his most popular works, although it didn't go down very well with the Victorian critic John Ruskin, who wasn't a great fan of Maclise, but otherwise it was critically acclaimed. And this is just another example of the sort of work he was producing at that time. But having cut his teeth on the medieval battle scenes in Strongbow and Ypres and the Norman Conquest, Maclise seems to have wanted to continue in this vein and show what he could do with a similar subject, but in a near-contemporary setting. And I think the point of this was not just to win the Royal Gallery commission, but also to recast his reputation and to prove that he was capable of more serious and important work. There had been some recent paintings of this very scene. The one at the top by the German artist Menzel is from 1858, and the one by the English artist Barker was from 1851. So I think he would have been aware of these. Barker's work was described by the critic of The Spectator, who observed that two men taking off hats to each other do not constitute the stuff of an historical picture. So I think Maclise had ambitious plans to outdo this sort of work. But he was also having a go at a much larger challenge, because battle painting in British art had a low status because it wasn't considered to be true history painting. Now that sounds like quite a strange statement, given all the battle scenes that you find in classical and Renaissance art and also in contemporary French painting. This is an example by Vernet from the Battles Gallery at Versailles, and that's an interesting precedent and parallel for the Royal Gallery. And this particular scene is one that Maclise certainly looked at. There are notes about it in the albums we saw earlier. But in Britain, the level of factual detail required to depict a specific conflict was thought to make depictions of battles primarily documentary. And correspondingly, images that were too grand or idealized were thought to lack sufficient factual basis to be considered as paintings of a real event. So to give a quick illustration of this scenario, I'm just going to look at two paintings of Waterloo that were produced shortly after the battle itself. So there's Turner's famous Field of Waterloo, painted in 1818. And as is usual with Turner, he tapped into the notion of the sublime, and he emphasized the magnitude and pathos and tragedy of the battle. It's not exactly an image of heroic victory, but it was quite well received. But to sum up the sort of attitude I'm talking about, one critic remarked, "It's more an allegorical representation of battle's magnificently stern array than any actual delineation of a particular battle." But on the other side of the equation was George Jones, who was a friend of Turner and became known as George Waterloo Jones. He was an old soldier himself. He'd served in Wellington's army in the Peninsular Wars. And as luck would have it for him, he also bore an uncanny resemblance to the Duke. So he made a whole career out of battle painting based on these PR advantages. And his work was, again, well-regarded, thought of as very much correct in terms of the factual basis, but his style was not considered to be great art in the way that it was defined by Joshua Reynolds and others. So this work was described as a diagram of that ever-memorable event. This is a most correct and valuable remembrancer, but not a great painting. So I think it's also significant to point out that one of the most popular paintings on the subject of Waterloo in the years directly after the battle was Wilkie's Chelsea Pensioners Reading the Waterloo Dispatch, or the Gazette of Waterloo, and that was commissioned by the Duke of Wellington himself. But it was a very clever solution from Wilkie, who avoided depicting the battle at all. Because Waterloo proved to be a rather difficult subject in art, partially because it required artists to capture the momentous nature of this epoch-changing event in just one image, but on a more practical level, it highlighted one of the perennial problems with depictions of warfare, and that's the extent to which the artist can show the true physical effects of the fighting. Waterloo was notoriously bloody, not because it was particularly any different in essence to any other battle of that era, but as one recent writer has put it, the problem was one of congestion. There were 50 to 60,000 troops killed and injured, along with many horses, in a relatively small space and in a relatively short time. And the kinds of devastating injuries sustained are very powerfully illustrated by objects like this breastplate of a French soldier, who was killed by a cannonball at Waterloo. That's not a great picture of it because it includes a selfie of me, but when you see the actual breastplate, the hole goes through here and straight out the back, and they put the cannonball there at the armories to really give the full effect. But it's something you can also see in these really horrible watercolours by the surgeon Charles Bell, who went to Waterloo shortly after the battle and helped to treat the injured of both sides, and he made a record of what he saw, so we won't linger on that one. But Maclise clearly opted not to show these kinds of injuries, and when you look at the cartoon, you can see that there's hardly a drop of blood in it. And this approach can be, to some extent, connected with the impact of neoclassicism in general, and specifically with Maclise's training at the School of Art in Cork, where he was drilled in the study of all of these examples of ancient Greek sculptures, and again at the Royal Academy, because this was a canon particularly valued for its dramatic but graceful and restrained beauty. So a man being attacked by a sea monster has this grimace on his face, but his body is still immaculate. This is, of course, still a current issue in depictions of warfare or commemoration of wars today. Jonathan Jones in The Guardian took issue with this installation of the ceramic poppies at the Tower of London last year. He described it as deeply aestheticized, prettified, and toothless war memorial. But I think it would be unfair to label the Waterloo cartoon as sanitized. I think Maclise was after a subtle balance. So the numbers of apparently dead or wounded figures are quite striking and in themselves give the impression of carnage without showing any of the visceral details. And this is also something that he achieved through some little subtle hints that he threw in. So on the right-hand side, for instance, you can see a man with a pity screw tourniquet on his arm. No blood, but a tourniquet to stem its flow. And these were often used before amputation on the battlefield. And that's something people would have known, so I think this would give them the idea. And on the left is a surgeon about to tend a soldier's leg, and he's unrolling this little tool set, which includes things like bone nippers and a lancet. So if anyone looked carefully, they'd get the idea that Maclise was aware of these things, even if he didn't show them. And another example of that sort of thing is on the far left there. You can see a detail from the wall painting. There aren't very many changes, but he did tweak it slightly. And something he added in this area in the wall painting was a group of looters, because the descriptions of the aftermath of Waterloo are really horrific, and as well as describing all of the injuries, they also describe how looters had stripped most of the dead of everything they had within a few hours. So most of them were actually lying in heaps on the field naked. So Maclise is giving a little knowing nod to that, but he doesn't actually show any of it, of course. So rather than showing mangled, naked corpses, Maclise gave the dead some dignity and the image a sense of decorum, which I think was appropriate to its setting in the Houses of Parliament. But interestingly, one of the few criticisms levelled at the cartoon and the wall painting at the time was that they were a bit soft on the French, not triumphalist enough. When you look at it, with a modern eye in particular, it's quite difficult to work out who's who. Who's French and who isn't. But the more I look at the cartoon, and with the help of the identifications of different people from the Royal Armouries, the more I see a very subtle patriotism at work. It's just not the tub-thumping that we might expect. It's very understated. So in the background on the top left, you can see the pursuit of French troops. Well, it turns out that that's not being undertaken by the Prussians, who actually did most of that work. These are members of the British Army chasing the French away. Many of the stoic wounded are also British. And on the left-hand side here, just in the left corner there, you can see a group of British soldiers who are helping to tend a fallen French general. The inclusion of Highlanders is another interesting point in this regard. Less than a century after the Jacobite Rebellion in 1745, Maclise is showing them as integrated as part of the British Army and suggesting this effect of the Napoleonic Wars to actually have a uniting effect on Britain. The even subtler thing here that's working on almost a subliminal level, I think, are some of the poses amongst the dead that mimic scenes from Christ's entombment by the old masters. So you've got a painting by Raphael up here, the Borghese entombment, and some examples of Maclise's use of this pose. It's very easy in 19th century painting to pick out poses that come from classical art or Renaissance art. But I think it's something that he deliberately did as a sort of motif in depictions of warfare. So we've got the cartoon on the left, but below that is a detail from Strongbow and Aoife, and here is a not very clear detail from one of the Norman conquest scenes. So it's something that you see over and over again in his work. So at first glance, I think the modern eye could interpret Maclise's image as almost being subversive or anti-war. But I think his message was rather that war is not something to be taken lightly. Now, ABBA's song Waterloo has been going around in my head for a good few years now. But one of the many profound lines in that is, how does it feel when you won the war? Well, according to Maclise, the answer appears to be not that great. His depiction of the two leaders shows them stony-faced, and the Duke is particularly grave, which is in keeping with descriptions of him on the night of the battle. He's even said to have wept when he heard the list of who had fallen. And so Maclise represents Waterloo as a duty for Wellington and Blücher, and one which has exacted a high human cost. So I think the Christ-like poses, here's another example, and symbols of martyrdom like the broken wheel, appear to be suggesting, however, that in circumstances like these, individual sacrifice is required for the greater good. Now, that's a message that might not come across very strongly when looking at the cartoon today, but I think it probably did in the 1920s when the cartoon was taken down from the walls of Burlington House. Now, by that stage, the cartoon was in a really bad condition after being up on the wall here for about 50 years. It was also hugely old-fashioned in terms of its style and was taking up a lot of space on the walls of the academy. But I really think the coup de grace was the image of a British commander shaking hands with his German counterpart over the bodies of so many young men. And I think it, in the aftermath of the First World War, which was felt quite keenly in a small institution like the RA, where most of the students had been sent off to fight and a lot of them hadn't come back, I think this would have been seen as quite inappropriate. So at the request of the academicians, the cartoon was taken down and sent instead to the Royal Military Academy at Sandhurst, where it was hoped it would be more appreciated. That wasn't entirely the case. It hung in the gymnasium, very close to some heating pipes, and by the early 1930s, its condition, which was already bad, was really deteriorating. So the paper was starting to disintegrate and fall off its linen backing, and insects were even finding their way through the back of the frame to start nibbling on the cartoon itself. And now, to be fair to the Royal Academy, they could have just left it at that and left it to rot, because that's what happened to a lot of cartoons. I mentioned the cartoon competitions at Westminster. Well, very few of those still survive. There's a few at Parliament itself. There's a few in the V&A and a few at places like the Watts Gallery, but that's basically it, because most of them fell apart. Most of them weren't quite as impressive as Maclise's example, but even so, they weren't seen as something necessary that could be preserved. To the Academy's credit, they did decide to do something about it, and they had the cartoon restored. So each panel was put onto a pulp board backing, and that saved it, but it has caused other problems. So it added to the discoloration of the paper, and it made the sides very vulnerable to damage. So the Academy then made a concerted effort to find somewhere to put their newly restored cartoon, because they still didn't want it on their own walls. But options explored included various public schools, Christchurch College in Oxford and the Crystal Palace in London, which was the one that they opted for. But very luckily for the cartoon, this loan was still in the final stages of being negotiated, just about a month or so before Crystal Palace burned down. So it had a lucky escape. But at that point, they gave up, and the cartoon went into storage at the Academy, probably not helped by the Second World War and the fact that Victorian art remained out of fashion for so long. It didn't surface again until 1972. So when Richard Ormond, who was the curator of that exhibition, requested to see it in 1970, the secretary of the RA cheerfully told him, "No one here has ever seen the Maclise cartoon, and that includes two of us who have been on the staff for 40 years. So it was well and truly buried. But before it could be displayed this year, therefore, it needed a little bit of TLC to stabilise its condition and improve its appearance. It's not currently possible to remove the paper from these pulpboard panels, so the conservators really focused on cleaning, removing old repairs, and treating losses and tears which were along the side of the panels. And this is just a couple of photographs of the temporary studio that we set up in the RA schools last year. And, I mean, they made some quite subtle differences, but altogether it has really improved the appearance and condition of the cartoon. But you can see some before and after. So on the left, two showing areas of damage on panel 8. And then at the bottom, you can see there that it's much less obvious. And similarly, at the top of panel 2, they took away this old repair, which basically they just put pastels over an old drip of water. So they took that off, and then you just have the drip mark, which actually looks better. And this is more of the same. But to draw to a close, I just wanted to say a few words about the wall painting. It has a very long story all of its own, which I won't go into, but if you go to the Houses of Parliament, there is an exhibition about that at the moment. To sum up very briefly, Maclise tried to paint in fresco, found that incredibly difficult to do something this size and this detailed in a damp environment. So he was encouraged to use something called the water glass technique, which was developed in Germany, and he went off on a fact-finding mission and came back and painted this and the death of Nelson in water glass. They didn't fare too well, unfortunately. But I should just say also that the whole contract was actually cancelled in the mid-1860s. After the death of Prince Albert, the whole thing was revised, and Maclise only ever painted these two works. He never painted the other 16 scenes. So although he didn't get to paint the rest of the Royal Gallery, his attempt to reinvigorate the depiction of battles in British art was acknowledged by his contemporaries. One of them described the Wellington and Blücher drawing as a new tract for battle painting. And he might well also be credited with contributing to the renewal of interest in large-scale mural painting in late 19th century Britain and the revival of Napoleonic subjects by painters like Lady Butler and William Quiller Orchardson. But so to end, I'd just like to read you Dante Gabriel Rossetti's assessment of Maclise's two Royal Gallery paintings. So he's not the first artist you might think of to appreciate works of this kind, but his description's very perceptive, and you can then go to the gallery and see if you agree with him. Rossetti wrote, "These works unite the value of almost contemporary record with that wild legendary fire and contagious heart pulse of hero worship, which are essential for the transmission of epic events through art. These are such historical pictures as the world had perhaps never seen before. These two splendid monuments of Maclise's genius he has left us, and we may stand before them with the confidence that only in the field of poetry and not of painting can the world match them as realized chronicles of heroic beauty." Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more information about the Royal Academy, please visit www.royalacademy.org.uk.